This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, we should say host, but also realtors with Oakland Realty in downtown Vancouver. I'm so excited to have today's guest. We've got Professor Marcus Mose. He is at the School of Planning at the University of Waterloo. Formerly, he did his PhD at University of British Columbia, so he knows Vancouver very well. He's studied Vancouver. He's studied Canadian cities. And of course, he's very interested in urban and regional planning. So excited to have Marcus on the show today. Tons of takeaways.
Yeah, he's kind of a famous guy. This is a get for the show. Really excited that Marcus joined us. You know, one thing I've been thinking about after this conversation, Adam, was I think that a lot of what Marcus talks about, youthification, and a lot of the other concepts we discussed today are super applicable to Vancouver and super applicable to how the neighborhoods across our region and especially across the city of Vancouver have developed over the last 10, 15 years. You know, I think the real question for everybody is, are you in a neighborhood that is forever young or something else? And that's, you'll have to listen to get a framework to understand
yes.
where you live in the city or where you want to live in the city. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah, Matt, it's a great conversation with Marcus. And I feel like what there's this idea that kind of dominates a lot of the conversations in Vancouver, at least in the real estate world, about areas that seem to kind of be hot areas kind of regardless of down markets. Like everybody's always kind of excited to be in this pocket. And then there's some laggers out there, some areas that seem to be stalled right now. And we often hear this term of carved out, like a certain neighborhood is carved out and or there's no families. This is kind of it takes the intangible and makes it tangible. So it's a great conversation in that regard. And like I said, lots to work with here, a lot of takeaways. And just a great conversation overall.
Yeah, the east-west divide to understand the city is no longer as relevant as it once was. Let's put it that way, Adam. But before we get to our conversation with Marcus, we do have the segment that remains nameless. This a quiz question for you, Adam, that I work tirelessly on to try and trip you up before we cut to our talk with our guest. This week, I think it's an easy one, but it was an obvious one. I had to go with the big takeaway out of the April stats that just came out. So, Adam, here is the question. We'll see if you can get this one. It's going to be embarrassing if you do not. In April 2026, only one of the three main property types, so that's condos, townhomes, and detached homes, Adam, only one of the main property types in the GVR stats saw sales rise compared to the same month last year or year over year. So which of the property types saw an increase in sales? Because I can tell you, Adam, the other two property types saw a decrease over 2025 year over year.
Right. Well,
before we get to that, you have a hot new listing you wanted to share.
Yeah, Matt, I'm so excited about this brand new listing. If you like views, unobstructed views of False Creek, unobstructed sunsets over False Creek, you're going to love this condo. It's a two-bed, two-bath at Boza Built Brighton, which is just an incredible property. So yeah, like I said, 1,050 square feet, completely renovated. They spent $240,000 renovating this condo. It's spectacular. And the outdoor space is huge. So you've got like over, I think it's 116 square feet of outdoor space that just kind of looks directly at False Creek. Two parking, storage, right in the best neighborhood. I mean, obviously Milross is right across the street from the seawall. Future upside is St. Paul's Hospital, which you could basically throw a baseball to. Tons of excitement around Northeast False Creek plan. We just had the chief planner from the city of Vancouver on to talk about that. And it sounds like what was stalled is no longer stalled. It sounds like they're making progress. So yeah, lots to be excited about. You can find more on our website, Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. The listing price, $1,199,900. So tucked under 1-2, what a special property.
Adam, did I miss the address? Did you give the address?
20042 Mill Ross Avenue, Matt.
It's phenomenal. That is a phenomenal building and a phenomenal listing. Congratulations to you. Congratulations to you, Adam. I would want to say that, of course, we have the sold plan over at Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. You can click on sell with us when you check out that listing. Of course, we have worked with hundreds of people who listen to the show, and we would love to help you sell your property or buy a property here in Vancouver. And you can find out more at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But let's cut back to our quiz question. You know, Adam, in hindsight, I should have asked you, is Science World really going to be a soccer ball for FIFA?
I drove by it today. It's wrapped
already. Is it
actually
a soccer ball? I just saw a photo and I thought it was AI.
No, it's wrapped. It looks great. So,
oh my God. Okay, I'm heading downtown after this. Well, Adam, let's get back to the quiz question. So just to remind everyone, in April, one of the three main property types saw a rise in sales year over year from April 2025. And two others did not. Which was the property type that saw an increase in sales?
Matt, it is the detached market. And the final answer, didn't even need to call a friend here. We are seeing an uptick in activity in detached homes. And you know what's great? Like, I feel like we've been saying this on the show for over a decade now, but if you can get into that detached market, dirt is always the best thing to own in Vancouver. And even in a down market, we're seeing great homes sell very quickly. So yeah, an interesting stat.
It is. They're up 14% over last year. Condos are down. Townhomes are down. It is true, Adam. The detached cycle tends to be quicker, and we're seeing an uptick. Detach leading the charge back. But maybe we should cut to our talk here with Marcus, because I was excited to have him on, and it did not disappoint.
If you love Vancouver, you're going to love this conversation.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing. Because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown, and we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much, and we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Marcus Mose. He's a professor at the School of Planning at University of Waterloo. Thanks for taking the time. How are you doing, Marcus?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks again, Marcus. Maybe for listeners who are not familiar with your work, can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
I'm a professor in the School of Planning and at the University of Waterloo, and have been here for the last 16 years. And I study housing markets and demographics and social structures in cities and the economies of cities and how those kind of act together to change our cities and what this kind of means for planning. One of the big things I study is generational change and how generational change shapes housing markets and how, you know, the changing structure of our cities influences different generations differently in terms of how they experience housing markets.
And Marcus, how did you get your start in planning? Like, why planning?
My background's quite diverse. So I actually have a joint bachelor's in environmental studies and economics, and was always very interested sort of in the interaction between environment, society, and economies. I did a master's in planning at Queen's University and then a PhD in geography. So I've got quite a sort of interdisciplinary background, but I ended up in planning, I think, because I'm inherently interested in policy outcomes, both looking at how policy affects cities, but also how change in cities might require policy responses for, you know, better societal and environmental outcomes. Particularly sort of from a sustainability and from a social justice lens, I'm often interested in equity outcomes, or looking at, you know, are things more or less affordable and for whom?
So Marcus, maybe as a broad starting point, how in your mind have cities evolved over your career? So the last, call it, couple decades.
That's a really good question. Yeah. I think the big change is that they've become a lot less affordable. I mean, things had already been unaffordable for, you know, a segment of the population when I first started out, but that definitely has changed in that middle class and even upper middle class is now finding the housing market unaffordable in some places. I think the knowledge economy sector has intensified even stronger in the center of large cities. And we've seen quite dramatic, you know, urban growth. And that growth in our big metropolitan areas has been kind of happening at two poles, if you will. There's really the centers have intensified and seen growth in density, but also our suburbs continue to grow at the edges of our cities. And so the story of urban change in Canada over the last couple of decades is one of centralization and one of decentralization at the same time.
Like in your, I'm just thinking of things that you're interested in and that you've mentioned. Is it a story of the knowledge economy primarily? Is it a story of generational change and kind of different desires of how to live? Like what's the driving kind of force at work in your mind?
Yeah, I think it's all of those, it's a lot of things together. So I think it's about partly about generational change, but it's also partly about, you know, economic changes that have seen the growth of the knowledge sector. But of course, not forgetting at the same time that we still have quite a large service sector, particularly, you know, in retail services. And of course, there's trades and manufacturing that still remain important parts of our economies, although smaller than they have been in the past. But in terms of generational change, it's difficult sometimes to generalize across generations, because generations are internally so diverse to some extent. But we're, you know, especially in the media, we tend to generalize and say millennials are like this and boomers are like this. But of course, when we look at generations, they're quite varied internally. But having said that, still, I think one of the things that we've observed is that particularly starting with the millennial generation, there have been a growth in interest in centralized living near transit in higher density settings. And partly that's a sort of desire for urban lifestyles, but it's also structural constraints, right? So it's not just about people choosing to live in higher density places. Partly that's an affordability question, that people are looking for smaller apartments because that's what they can afford.
You know, part of the reason we wanted to have you on today is to talk about this idea of youthification. Can you walk us through what you mean by youthification and how it might apply to some of the larger cities like Vancouver and Toronto?
Yeah, for sure. I started during my PhD, actually, I started studying young adults and their residential locations and housing decisions. And it became very apparent that when I looked at those over time, the residential locations of young adults, loosely defined sort of 25 to 34 years old, that we've seen over time an increasing association with density. So young adults more likely to live in higher density housing than in the past. Young adults have often, you know, even in the past, lived in higher density housing just because by virtue of the smaller household sizes. But over time, that effect has intensified. And so what I started referring to as youthification was these neighborhoods where young adults, you know, sometimes had 2-3 times the concentration of young adults that you would see across the metropolitan area. So really high concentration of young adults in specific neighborhoods. But the The other part of youthification is not just the concentration of young adults in specific neighborhoods, but it's actually that those neighborhoods stay young over time. So I sort of refer to them as forever young neighborhoods, right? Is that the young adults actually move out of those neighborhoods as they age and new young adults move in. And so especially now with more recent census data, we've seen that trend continue both in the US and Canada. Sort of millennials started to age and Gen Z started moving, you know, in behind and started actually moving into some of these neighborhoods. And so, yeah, youthification is about sort of a process of channeling young adults into the center and other high density neighborhoods of our cities. And it's a combination of lifestyle choices, but also very importantly, it's, you know, structural reasons like affordability, where our housing market has expanded in terms of the smaller dwelling sizes, changes in our household composition and size. So a lot of more smaller households and young adults going to school longer, choosing not to have children or having children later in their lives. So the young adult phase, if you will, has actually kind of expanded over time, that people sort of stay in that young adult phase for a longer period of time. And that creates these kind of unique neighborhood conditions where you suddenly have both real estate, but also amenities kind of targeting young adults in specific neighborhoods. And so you kind of start almost getting neighborhoods that, you know, that have a lot of young adults also reflecting that in the amenity compositions, a lot of coffee shops, a lot of restaurants, you know, potentially clubs and other kinds of things, music venues that that are attractive to young adults. So yeah, youthification is about young adults moving into neighborhoods and then moving out as they age, particularly as they tend to have children, they tend to move out of those neighborhoods.
Is that, in your mind, Marcus, is that new? Like, is that a new phenomenon in the last, say, call it 3 decades? Or is it something that's kind of always taken place in urban centers? And is it, I guess, I'm just thinking there's kind of, transient might not be the right word because, you know, presumably this is somewhere where somebody lives for 10, 12 years before they have kids and move out. But is it a positive development if it is a new development?
Right. So to some extent, it's not new. As you like, you rightly say that young adults have often lived in the center of large cities, but it's definitely intensified. So, you know, at the center of our cities, especially sort of coming out of the 50s, had a lot more manufacturing and a lot more jobs than residents. Certainly there were, you know, apartment buildings and some higher density neighborhoods, but for the most part, the center of cities was more a place of employment than a place to live. Now, as the economy shifted towards more services and knowledge intensive industries, we've also seen the center of our cities change and lose significant proportions of manufacturing and warehousing activity. And Vancouver, of course, is a prime example of that, where the downtown really switched from being more of a place of, you know, warehousing and manufacturing and resource intensive sectors to being sort of a hub for knowledge intensive services. I mention that because that sort of creates the setting for downtowns to become more places to live and more attractive as places of residence than they have in the past. So definitely, you know, young adults have generally moved into the higher density neighborhoods, partly because their household sizes have long been smaller, but that young adult phase has extended in time. And there's larger shares of young adults concentrating at higher numbers in those neighborhoods. And as a result, I think we've also seen the higher concentration of amenities that really cater to those young adults. So some people talk about, you know, downtowns being playgrounds for a young adult lifestyle. So it's really about a greater concentration. And it's about neighborhoods really becoming very specifically targeted also from a branding perspective, if you will, from a real estate side of things, really branded for young adult lifestyles. You've asked the question about whether that's a positive change. I mean, to some extent, moving more people into denser neighborhoods, you know, at an early life cycle stage is beneficial from a sort of public interest planning perspective, because we're often trying now to get people to walk more, cycle more, and use transit more for environmental reasons and also for health-related reasons and reduce automobile use. So the more people you have living in higher density neighborhoods, the easier it is to get people out of the automobile and use other transportation modes. And when people live at higher densities, also you get a reduction in land consumption to some extent. So it's positive in that sense, but it also has sort of the downsides in that we've seen greater segregation of generations, so that young people are more likely to live with other young people to a greater extent and for longer periods of time. And that sort of raises questions about intergenerational dynamics, right? Does it become harder for generations to understand each other when they don't interact with each other as much on a day-to-day basis? Or society has, you know, long been sort of generationed that we go to school, we go to work, and we're at different ages in those periods of our lives. But certainly in residential terms, we are seeing a greater separation of people by age.
So I'm just curious about class and this intergenerational, like, I guess, is youthification gentrification? And is it strictly a generational thing? Or because, like, you know, we work in downtown Vancouver and the surrounding areas, and it seems like it's a very specific, some neighborhoods attract very specific types of people, whether it's, you know, the knowledge workers you talk about. But how does gentrification and for lack of a better term, class kind of factor in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a very important question. I'm really glad you're raising that, because I don't want to suggest that youthification replaces gentrification. In fact, they're simultaneous processes. And I think the two processes help us better understand urban change together. But one is about social class, and that's gentrification, right? And that's really about the in-movement of higher income earners into traditionally lower class neighborhoods, and then the displacement of those lower income populations because rents rise and housing prices rise. With the youthification, really, it's partly about, or it's really not just partly, but in large part, it's about age, right? It's about life cycle stage. And what we see is that we see young adults across the income spectrum moving to some of these higher density neighborhoods, but for different reasons, right? Some people move in really for affordability reasons. That's where they can find the smaller rental apartment, is in some of the higher density neighborhoods. Others move in to purchase the condo and, you know, actually can enter home ownership. But we see a sort of diversity of incomes among young adults in youthified neighborhoods. When we've studied the processes simultaneously, we've seen that, you know, youthification and gentrification occur together, but they can also be separate processes, because gentrification happens not just by young people, and youthification isn't just about higher income earners moving in. So one is about age and the other is about social class. And both of those factors shape how our cities, you know, change and function.
Marcus, is this a high cost of living story, like for high cost of living cities, or is it kind of something that's happening in cities throughout Canada? And is it more accelerated in high cost of living cities?
Yeah, it's definitely more accelerated in high cost of living cities. And it's, you know, particularly pronounced in large cities, so in the largest metropolitan areas. But it does happen sort of across the urban system. So even in, you know, medium-sized metropolitan areas like Kitchener-Waterloo, where I am, we're seeing some parts of our central cities becoming more youthified, as well as having large student populations, of course, which is another process at play here, is the sort of what's been referred to as studentification. But certainly youthification has been sort of seen across the metropolitan system. But when we've studied it both in the US and in Canada, it seems to be heavily associated with a knowledge economy. So cities with larger knowledge economy sectors tend to have higher shares of youthified neighborhoods. So, and those are also, you know, the more quote-unquote successful cities in the knowledge economy are the ones that are going to be more expensive because they're in higher demand because that's where the jobs are. And so young people are more likely to move to those cities, partly for jobs. And then also because they're high growth cities, we're seeing high demand for property and rental accommodation, which then, you know, sort of drives up the price. And so you're kind of getting a story of labor demand, young people moving to cities with jobs, but also one I think that probably shouldn't be downplayed is sort of one of, you know, young people seeking out cities they want to live in for lifestyle reasons.
I just want to bring up, because the first thing that comes to mind is COVID and the pandemic and how that kind of flipped everything on its head. In thinking about your research, is that something that was like do you see that as like a temporary blip in this trend, or is that something that's going to have lasting impacts on, you know, work from home, where people decide to live, where that knowledge base decides to live and work?
Yeah, I guess the classic academic answer is that it's both. So where I don't have to decide between one or the other. No, but it's certainly, you know, those processes kind of play out together. Now, certainly during COVID, we've seen an out movement of some younger populations. They tended to be white collar workers in particular, because that there's also the link to being able to work from home, but also being able to move into, say, ownership in the outer suburbs or in smaller metropolitan areas surrounding the big cities. So there's definitely an out movement of people that, in my view, kind of would have likely moved out anyways, but COVID might have accelerated it, as they were looking for more, you know, family-friendly, larger accommodation to have more room for having children in particular. What we have seen is that some of this has reversed, and, you know, the centers of our big cities have seen in movement again, and young adults in particular, you know, aren't moving away in large numbers. Part of that is just that a good chunk of our jobs, as we've all kind of come to realize, is now back in office. And people are also, as the lockdowns ended, people are also, you know, more likely wanting to be in cities again because the amenities of urban living are actually available again. So I think part of the reason people moved away from the large city is the very reason you live there is a lot of things that were closed and not available to you during COVID lockdowns, right? So once that opened up again, you kind of made the benefits of urban living became available again. So it's a blip in the sense that probably larger numbers moved out, but it's not a blip in the sense that I would say it did sort of raise the question, and I think maybe it highlighted the issue that we're facing in a lot of Canadian cities, is that we didn't tend to build very much larger housing in the center of our large cities, so that households with, you know, particularly those growing with children, will move out because they can't find suitable housing that is affordable at a price, and suitable being sort of a fit between number of rooms that they need to accommodate a certain household size. So that, I think, became highlighted during the pandemic, that people were saying, well, you know, now that I don't have to be right downtown because of my job, I can work from home. Oh, I can find something a little bit larger than I could in the downtown, and we don't have to live in the one bedroom or the two bedroom, and we can find something a bit larger and have more room for our children. And so density is very, I suppose, divorced from family housing in a Canadian context, but it doesn't necessarily need to be that way, I think, as we see, you know, internationally, where we see more families living in higher density contexts as well.
In your mind, how would, as a planner, would you approach that? Because it sounds like in other cities around the world, cores or urban areas are kind of more inclusive generationally, I guess, or for families. What does that entail? Because one of the things that I'm just thinking about as you're talking is, like, Vancouver has all sorts of community plans and an official plan now where there's going to be these new villages planned for, and it's very kind of transit oriented and multimodal transportation and lifestyle driven. And Adam and I both live in areas that are like that in the city, and it's a fantastic place to live. But are there blind spots there in terms of how cities like Vancouver are being planned and developed?
Yeah, I think there are blind spots, but there's also trade-offs that people are making, right? To some extent, people are willing to live in smaller dwellings for the urban amenities, for the downtown living. And so we're seeing that to some extent, that people are, you know, say, well, I'm okay living in a smaller apartment because when I go out my front door, there's the city of Vancouver with all its amenities and the ocean and the mountains nearby. And I partly pay for this through the real estate market, right? Is the proximity to these natural amenities. And Vancouver's done a, I would argue, particularly good job in planning the public realm so that there's green space integrated into the high density area so that when you do come out of your higher density apartments, let's say, you actually have access to green space. You know, a colleague of mine, Pierre Fillion, and I, we like to joke that in some cities, there's the model of towers in the parking lot as opposed to towers in the park, which is a more traditional sort of planning model would be to build towers in the park, which I think Vancouver to some extent has adopted. But in some cases, and we do see that quite a bit in Waterloo, where I am, is to be get the tower in the parking lot. And then I think the trade-off that people are willing to make between higher density living and, you know, urban amenities aren't necessarily available. But to some extent, so that's sort of saying, okay, people are willing to make some of those trade-offs. And so we're moving kind of in the right direction. But the other part of it, of course, is that family-sized housing really isn't available, I would argue, in the numbers that it needs to be to retain families with children. And, you know, some city, like the city of Toronto has in the past tried to mandate number of bedrooms in some of the neighborhoods. And, you know, that can work to some extent, but it also then makes the dwellings particularly expensive because you're building market-based housing in larger market-based housing in already expensive areas. And so I think when you look internationally, I think really we have to recognize that in most of those markets where you have more integrated living, it's really the governments have turned to non-market housing to integrate different types of incomes into neighborhoods and looking to, you know, subsidized housing to as a way to integrate different types of populations in neighborhoods. Because I think it's inherently difficult now, given our land markets, to build larger dwellings that are actually affordable to a wide range of the population.
You know, I'm just thinking about the type of housing that we're building. And it sounds to me like at least this push for like market rental housing in your mind is that we'll actually be able to get and maybe keep some of the families that want to live in urban centers. Because we've had a Jens von Bergman, the data analyst in Vancouver, on talking about how Vancouver is losing a lot of its families and the challenge with that. I guess, what are Canadian cities getting wrong in your mind in terms of housing and the creation of housing? And also specifically, I guess, in these urban centers, when it comes to housing younger generations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've kind of really adopted, I guess, what you could characterize as tall and sprawl. So, you know, in our cities, we have a lot of really high density neighborhoods, but we have a lot of really low density neighborhoods as well. And we seem to be lacking, and, you know, I'm not the only one let alone the first to say this, is that we're really lacking and missing what's been referred to as the missing middle housing. So you could have more medium density, mid-rises, ground-oriented housing, but that is provided a higher density than what you can achieve through single detached housing. So I think that's one of the primary gaps in our cities, is that sort of missing middle. But also I would say, you know, we've sort of moved away. This happened at all levels of government, but particularly, you know, federally and provincially, we've moved away over the last sort of 3-4 decades from the provision of affordable housing to an extent that used to be the case in Canada when you look back to sort of the 60s and 70s, where there was a larger investment in affordable subsidized housing, in non-market housing, in cooperative housing. And so, you know, it's about the dwelling type, but it's also about the way those housing types are financed that allows different kinds of people to access different neighborhoods. And so I think it's partly a story of needing to increase the density of our central neighborhoods that are still very low density, but also doing so in a way that is actually affordable to a broader segment of the population. And the rental market, as you brought up, definitely can play a role there, and a larger role, I think, than it has in the past in Canada.
Well, what are your thoughts on gentle density?
Yeah, I think a gentle density is to some extent a term that's used to describe sort of to add, you know, missing middle housing. Part of the issue is that depending on how it's actually implemented, if gentle density is only about, say, you know, basement suites and laneway homes, it's probably just not enough to actually make a big difference. And in some ways, some of those income streams are actually capitalized into the housing market. People then expect an income stream from their basement suite or their laneway home as part of the financing of the ownership model. So it becomes kind of,
right.
Yeah. So I think when gentle density means really gentle, I don't think it's actually enough. But I think, you know, moving away from assuming that density just means putting up high-rise apartment buildings, I think that's the other extreme, and that we can sort of arrive more at a middle where we have a mix of housing types in our neighborhoods that are also compatible with each other in terms of form, the different housing types, so that you don't have single attached housing right beside high-rise buildings and people looking into each other's dwellings that way.
Marcus, maybe this is a little bit outside your wheelhouse, but the provincial government in British Columbia has taken some steps to basically rezone large swaths of the province for to implement multiplexes. I think there's certain similarities to what's going on in areas of Ontario, although I don't think from the province. What's your take on like a provincial mandate? Is that good planning policy for sixplexes and fourplexes being allowed on single family lots?
I would say, you know, generally speaking, housing development definitely depends on the local neighborhood context. And so sometimes blanket approaches can be a little too heavy-handed. At the same time, we have seen such, you know, a large share of our housing is single detached homes, that mandating it at the provincial level has the benefits that not suddenly one municipality changes its zoning and then is maybe at a disadvantage over other municipalities. So there is benefits to doing it at a provincial level. And it's also signaling very strongly that you're pointing towards the different kinds of communities, that we're moving towards different kinds of communities in the long run. And so to me, as long as those decisions are made by, you know, democratically elected governments, then I think these decisions do warrant sometimes provincial intervention. I think generally speaking, those interventions are warranted because when you relax zoning, I think the research, you know, over the years has really shown is that you increase the amount of housing built and you increase housing supply. And I think that's one of the benefits of those supply side reforms, I guess, if we call them that, is that you're relaxing zoning constraints, which have, you know, in many ways reduced the housing supply because of exclusionary zoning.
Marcus, I feel like Canadians, and I've seen the odd study comes out every once in a while where it talks about Canadian ownership is still at the forefront of most young people's minds. People want to buy homes in Canada and they want to buy homes primarily for stability, I think is one of the largest driving factors. Do you think home ownership is still a realistic goal for the average young Canadian, or do we need to rethink what housing success looks like for young people?
Mm-hmm. I think you've, you know, sort of hit the nail on the head there when you said stability, because I think that's one of the main reasons in the Canadian context people still pursue ownership is because our rental market just does not provide the same kind of stability that ownership does. And so people still pursuing it, even when it's financially straining on them. So I think one of the things that, you know, might actually help from affordability perspective is greater tenant protections that exist in some of the European countries as well, where a much larger share of people is in the rental market. Ownership, you know, should it still be pursued? I guess it's kind of a question of, to some extent, the entry price point has become so high to some extent that it's, for some reason, for some segments of the population, it's not almost should it be pursued, but they simply cannot pursue it, right? But sort of segments of the population that have dual incomes, that maybe are flexible geographically, you know, in terms of where they would live within a metropolitan region, and maybe have some assistance from family wealth as well, home ownership to some extent still makes the most sense for that segment of the population. But it's certainly then we're linking home ownership much more with privilege than we have in the past, where home ownership was much more universal in the Canadian context.
I feel like this is awesome for us because we're just peppering you with questions. But I just, maybe shifting gears a little bit, Marcus, and this might be a overly simplistic, we're not planners, that's for sure, overly simplistic kind of framing of it. But at one point in the conversation, you kind of went back to, you know, the 1950s and 1960s and thinking about how cities have evolved. I'm kind of curious, because I know you've done some work on suburbs and that kind of suburb core relationship. How should we either rethink that, or is that a useful kind of framing? How are you thinking about suburbs, and especially suburbs in places like Metro Vancouver, where increasingly it feels like there's no clear, you either live downtown or in the suburbs kind of scenario?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've done some work in the past where we looked actually at suburbs, like suburban ways of living, where we is moving away from a place-based definition where we sort of say, oh, there's the inner city and there's the suburb, because that sort of dichotomy actually does tend to sort of simplify things in a way that isn't accurate of the way our metropolitan regions actually function. And so we try to come up with, you know, more varied definitions of different kinds of suburban areas. And so in Vancouver, you can actually see that very, very nicely as an example of the way that the SkyTrain moves into suburban areas, and where you see some of those higher density, I guess I'd call them secondary nodes, but they're, you know, cities in their own right, but secondary sort of to the urban center, where you're seeing these higher density suburbs that then actually have some much more urban ways of living. And so the distance from the center of the metropolitan area used to be kind of more stringently associated with lower density. So the, you know, as you moved away from the center of metropolitan areas, density kind of decreased at a steady rate, whereas now we're seeing much more polycentric cities where you have secondary centers in our metropolitan areas, which kind of changes the dynamic of where people can live and where people can access amenities and where jobs go as well. And so these secondary centers are in some extent helpful because they spread out jobs to a greater degree, so that not all employment is concentrated in the core, which then creates great, you know, competitiveness for wanting to access the core, both for commuting, but also for wanting to live nearby. So this polycentric urban form has to some extent benefits in that it can diffuse the pressure on the core metropolitan area. But in terms of, you know, suburban ways of living, I mean, the suburbs really had been traditionally associated with single detached housing, home ownership, and driving your automobile. And that, of course, has changed to some extent as well, as more people are renting in the suburbs, that we see more transit in the suburbs. Even though, on the whole, driving still and the single detached housing are still the dominant housing form in our suburbs. And that's partly just the product of, you know, the sort of the way that housing stock changes very slowly. So a lot of the newer housing, the newer subdivisions, as you probably know, are coming up with a much greater mix of housing than some of the subdivisions that were built in the 50s and 60s mm-hmm. that were more predominantly single detached. But also important to remember that our cities in the 50s and 60s were a lot smaller. And so, you know, the suburbs then were what we now often refer to as the inner suburbs that we now actually sometimes think are very close to the metropolitan core. And so we were able at the time to sort of serve our inner suburbs with transit in a way that now is the outer suburbs haven't really kept up in many instances. Vancouver is a bit of an exception with the SkyTrain going quite a ways out into the outer suburbs. But more generally speaking, across Canadian metropolitan areas, it's very hard for people to access transit, or when they do need it for necessity, it tends to be, you know, very slow mode to get around in the outer suburbs, because we have this sort of homogeneous low density land use that still dominates a lot of our metropolitan areas.
Marcus, I'm just thinking about, like, so you're absolutely right that I feel like housing does kind of move slowly, like these changes. Is there like a North Star city or country that seems to be getting it right based on what our needs are, based on your research? Is there a city that you think is doing a tremendous job of kind of, I guess, making it more accessible for not only young people, but making sure that cities are inclusive and thriving, nailing the density angle?
I haven't personally done, specific international comparisons in my written research, but certainly I come across a lot of international examples in my work. And I think one of the cities people often point to is Vienna, because it has a large segment of the housing in non-market housing and in subsidized housing. That's certainly one that people point to from a non-market perspective. But also, when we look internationally, I actually think that from a planning perspective, in terms of trying to get it right, in terms of planning for the public realm, we can look very close to home and look at a place like Vancouver and say, actually, a lot has been done right, I would argue, in terms of how we've planned for green space, for walkable communities, for transit-oriented communities. I think the big missing component in Vancouver is the affordability piece. And I think that's a larger story across Canada, where we've relied very much on market housing to try and meet affordability needs that are very difficult to meet when you have market housing that is driven by macro level forces as well as international investment, and housing markets sort of become almost decoupled from local incomes. And so really we need a recoupling of those housing markets with incomes, and it's very difficult to do that when land prices are as high as they are, construction costs are what they are. And so at some level of government intervention is what you see internationally when cities are more affordable and inclusive, a lot, across continental Europe, for instance.
So, and that's one of the things we've been talking on the show a lot lately is just how the creation of housing in Vancouver is dependent on market housing, is dependent on investors. And a lot of the housing stock, whether it's rental, it's all market housing or mostly market housing in Vancouver, the large majority of it. Do you see the future and the success of the city depending on weaning ourselves off of this kind of market cycle, build and then stop building and build and stop building? Or do you see us do you see the need for more, how do we move forward, I guess, in a way that we're not so dependent on market housing?
Yeah, I think, governments at all levels have to show leadership in basically creating mechanisms for funding non-market housing so that it becomes a larger share of our housing mix. There's no illusion here that our housing market is predominantly market-based, and we're not going to change that from one day to the other. There's too many factors that are hinging on us having a market-based housing. There's benefits to having a market-based housing in terms of people's ability to save for retirement, for instance. So, moving away from market-based housing would have to be a process that will take some time. And I don't know, if we really within our lifetime, you could suddenly have 50% non-market housing or something like that in across Canada. I don't think that's the numbers we're looking at. But increasing the share of non-market housing basically creates a segment of the market that where people are no longer competing, right? And so you're at, just like new housing is generally a small, new market housing is generally a small share of the overall housing stock, right? We add sort of between 1% and 2% would even be a very high share of new housing in any given year. So the majority of our housing is our existing housing stock, but the new housing is almost a little bit of a pressure valve as growth is occurring. And so as growth happens, you're getting some people moving into these new areas that otherwise would also be competing for the existing housing stock. And so non-market housing moves some people out of the market competition and could see some, reduced competition for the rental market as well, in particular. So I think I would argue strongly that we need to move towards a larger share of non-market housing, but we have to be realistic of how much that share can actually be given our current context and how long we've depended on market housing for, the primary provision of our homes.
Marcus, I guess being aware of your time here, I just have, really two more questions quickly. One is just thinking about the kind of generational changes and how people are living in cities, fewer kids, at least over the last decades, more, really increasing immigration and now pulling back, of course, but presumably Canada needs immigrants to, in the long run, it's inevitable. But what does the future of a city like Vancouver, say, look like over the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years with the kind of changing lifestyles? Like I said, like fewer children, the push towards transit-oriented living, like what new immigrants being the main driving of new population growth. What does the future of cities look like in your mind? And our futures of city, or and our cities the future? Sorry.
That's an excellent question. I wish I had that crystal ball, you know, where I can look forward and say, here's what's going to happen over the next next 50 years. But certainly we can look a little bit, you know, what's kind of has lock-in effects, if you will. And the housing stock, as we mentioned before, is very permanent. And so some of those things aren't suddenly going to go away. And so, you know, we have now created a higher density housing stock in the center of our cities with smaller apartments and smaller housing stock near transit. And so I think it's going to continue that we see the smaller households live near transit and in the high density areas, unless there's some significant intervention from the government to provide subsidized housing near transit. That would be my guess. So that would be the variable of distinction, I would say. If we suddenly start investing really heavily on affordable housing near transit, we could see a shift of who lives near transit. But the immigration component too is very important and is a difficult one to predict, right? But certainly I think, yes, I would agree that immigration is going to continue in the Canadian context, and is especially in a context of an aging population. Immigration, I think, is very important for the Canadian context. What that means in terms of housing is that many of the immigrant communities actually have a much higher share of intergenerational living than domestic-born populations, right? And so I think that in and of itself is shifting where immigrant populations move to, because it's much more difficult to accommodate an intergenerational household in a small apartment than it is in a single detached home. And so to some extent, the single detached home has great flexibility in that you can adapt it to intergenerational living, even, you know, creating a separate apartment, a granny suite, as it's called. Maybe you have a laneway home, whereas that's much more difficult to do with apartments. So I think there's going to continue to be demand for lower density suburban housing from intergenerational immigrant households that are going to be looking for those larger dwellings. At the same time, a lot of those populations are moving from places where transit is much more heavily used. And actually, we sort of see this, that immigrants, you know, use transit more heavily when they first move, and they sort of accustom to the average Canadian way over time and start using transit less and less as they live in Canada longer over time. So if we are interested in getting people more on transit for environmental reasons, I think we have to find ways to keep people on transit when they're already on it. And I think that has partly to do with that gentle density, medium density approach, so that we do have a level of density in our suburban neighborhoods that is conducive to providing at least some level of public transit. Whereas if we build too low density and too dispersed, with, you know, sort of street patterns that make it difficult for transit to run through in an efficient way, we're going to be gridlocked, I think, as the cities grow. And I mean, I know Vancouver has congestion. I think in Toronto, congestion is, you know, is a really big discussion regionally as well on the 401. And so a lot of that, you know, is that congestion is not just going to go away in the next couple of decades. But I think it's going to change in the sense that if we can increase transit options, it's going to be able to shift some people away from using the car. I don't think we'll see a dramatic shift where suddenly in 10 years, everybody's going to be on transit or on a bike. But I think we're going to see movements in that direction, particularly as gas prices, you know, now, of course, for very specific reasons, but gas prices might continue to rise. So that's another sort of factor at play. So I don't have the really satisfactory answer of where I can say this is what cities are going to be like 50 years from now. But I think what I would look to is things like immigration policy, gas prices, subsidized housing, and the ways in which those are being provided that would shape our cities one way or the other, right? And I think if we're not careful, we're going to continue to increase congestion and drive our housing market prices up and up. And that will disperse the population even more and make it more difficult to have, you know, the sort of localized lives that many of the plans envision. And so I think the future of Canada is probably in the cities, just because of path dependency in part. But importantly, of course, from a planning perspective, we'd say that we have to be really careful we don't forget about the small town and rural areas, which are important components of our country as well, right? So the idea of regional planning to some extent is highly important, that we sort of think about our rural, small town, medium-sized cities and larger cities in conjunction with each other and how they sort of function as a big system together. But certainly in terms of population concentrations, I think it's going to be the cities and its surrounding metropolitan areas.
That's really interesting stuff.
Yeah, and Marcus, we do have this segment called the Five Wire, Five Lighthearted Questions we end every show with. Can you stick around for that?
Sure.
So first question is, one book that you've read recently that you would recommend for our listeners?
Well, one book that I've read recently, one book that I'm just actually... I have it right here on my desk because I haven't gotten really into it, but it seems to have a lot of promise, seems to be very interesting. It's called Messy Cities and nice. Why We Can't Plan Everything, right? And sort of makes a case for letting cities grow organically as well.
You know, from an outsider's perspective, very much an outsider, it does feel like there's that Jane Jacobs, I think, kind of, it seems like it goes back and forth, right? Between like, mm-hmm. organic versus, maybe that's too simple. It's probably like, you'd, if I was in your intro class, you'd shut me down, but it's kind of an interesting back and forth. in the last few years, Marcus, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Oh, my own life. What is my belief or habit? That's a good one. Accepting that life circumstances very much dictate what we can do on a daily basis, and sort of living the life you're given to some extent, I think has been a improvement for well-being, I would say.
Ah, that's great.
That is great.
This question always feels jarring after that question, but what have you been binge watching lately, or a movie recommendation?
What have I been binge watching? You know what I've binge watched actually is a couple of things, and they happen to have both the same actor in them. It's I've been rewatching The Office, and some of that holds up and some of it does not hold up, I'll say. But I've also been watching a show called Rooster, which has similar which is
Steve Carell.
Steve Carell, which is about an author who goes onto a university campus. So it's, I guess, a bit close to my own day-to-day life as well, in that the most recent movie I saw, well, two most recent, the one is the Hail Mary Project, and that certainly was very interesting. I might have gotten the title slightly wrong there, but I think you know which one I mean, with Ryan Gosling. The other one I saw with my daughter just actually this weekend is the Super Mario Brothers, which is just light entertainment, but as somebody who grew up with, you know, Nintendo as one of the first sort of play and remembers the first generation Nintendo, watching a Super Mario Brothers movie is always fun.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Favorite band or music you're currently listening to?
Favorite band ever since I was 14 has been Green Day, and I still listen to it quite frequently, and I've been actually quite pleasantly surprised that my daughter seems to like some of their songs as well.
it's funny, they're one of those, they're almost like the Rolling Stones of the 90s music, it seems. Mm-hmm.
They're also classic rock now. Yeah. So
that's right.
Last but not least, Marcus, something that you have purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life?
I guess if we don't go too recently back, it's a small guitar. That is a guitar that's sort of in between a ukulele and a regular guitar. And, I play guitar for pleasure, but I love playing guitar, and buying one that's a bit travel sized has had a positive impact on my life because I can bring it more places. but it also has sort of this cool summery sound to it. So it always makes me think of holidays when I play it.
Oh, that's great.
Right on. Marcus, how can people find out more about what you're doing? I don't know if you're active on social media or not, but where can people find out more about your work?
It's best to go to the University of Waterloo School of Planning website. So if people Google my name, they should be able to make their way there. Also, actually, I'm on the only social media that I'm on at the moment is Instagram, which is a bit of a different outlet for me. That's where I post my art, which is urban planning inspired art, but it's definitely different than my day-to-day academic research.
Oh, neat.
Oh, that's great. We'll have to give you a follow here. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Marcus, for coming on, and tons of takeaways from that conversation. So really glad we got the opportunity.
Thanks so much for having me. That's a lot of fun.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Marcus Mose, professor over at the University of Waterloo. And, you know, Adam, just thinking back to this, and this might not have been captured, he said it felt like his dissertation defense. We just peppered him with questions coming from all different angles. And I think he passed with distinction.
Yeah, I don't know what that means, but yeah. He did well.
I'm just impressed that we're giving him a distinction.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Full damn.
Yeah, I know. He's like, this is like going through a useless hiring committee. Anyways, it was fun picking his brain. Loved asking him questions. Really thoughtful guy. And like I said, I said before we cut to the interview, if you love Vancouver, you'll love this conversation. I've been thinking about this conversation for the past few weeks. Because I like, you know, it's what we've talked about, but it's always nice to kind of hear like a framework for understanding what's happening in a city that kind of just gives you some guidance when you're thinking about complexity and where people are moving to and why they're moving there and how cities are being shaped. And I think Marcus did a great job of unpacking that idea for us. So yeah, really interesting conversation. What else do we got before we cut for the day, Matt?
What else do we have before we cut for the day? Well, Adam, I said it at the top and I'll say it before we cut. We're excited to work with people who listen to the podcast. So we have a 5-star review rating on Google. We'd love to help you sell your home. We'd love to help you buy your home. We have resources over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for buyers, for sellers. Go check it out or get in touch. If you want to get in touch with me at any time, 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah, you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Always love to hear from you. And we will be back next week talking Granville Street.
Oh, yeah. This is a great one. I can't wait for this.
Yeah. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Take care. Have a good week.
2,000 Faces for Radio.
Subscribe today.